Welcome to Deep Dive MH370, Episode 26, Restarting the Search. Hello, I'm Andy Tarnoff. I'm the president and publisher of OnMilwaukee.com, a daily magazine and city guide. And I am joined again by Jeff Wise, aviation journalist, MH370 expert, author of The Taking of MH370. And as of last week, I'm going to call you an international media star, Jeff.
I did do a lot of international media last week. That's true. I was getting up at weird hours. It was all to promote this podcast, which I think was great. We actually have a lot of new listeners and viewers.
I would say exciting. It worked. This was by far the most traffic we've ever received and the most engagement we've ever received in just 1 week. And part of that was because this last week was the 10th anniversary of the disappearance of MH370. I'd like to think part of it was because of all that earned media that both of us did and the quality of that episode. I'm really proud of that one.
Yeah, it was the culmination, I would say, of a lot of work on our part. And if you haven't seen it, go see it, please. Somebody said, was that your last episode? I'm like, no. It was like kind of our culmination, but it was not the end. It was just sort of a local climax, I would say.
Yeah, it was like the end of the first part of our storytelling, maybe, but there's quite a bit.
It was kind
more.
Of like kind of forced up that sort of. Beat was forced upon us in a sense by the turn of events, but I think we were ready. There was two big things we wanted to unveil, and we did unveil them. If that's too mysterious for you, again, go back and watch the episode. But it has left us in a position where we're like reaching more people, and that's always great because the more people we reach, the more people we will continue to reach.
Yeah. So let me ask you a question, just because I'm interested. So you were on Fox and Friends. You were on Australian TV. Mm-hmm. You did some radio. I did some radio. Out of all of these, what do you think was the
most effective?
Most effective, weirdest, coolest, most interesting. I mean, you've been doing TV for many, many years, so you're not new to this kind of stuff.
I don't want to diverge too much into media theory, but it's definitely the case that, like, if you go on Fox and Friends, you know, you will get a lot of clicks. And that did happen, even though I was on at like 6:20 in the morning or something. I was at the start of the show. But the thing that had the most effect really was an article that I wrote for New York Magazine that was it was basically kind of getting into the science of the barnacles and like why the science of it was so strange. And because of the way that an online article lives and spreads versus a TV show, where kind of a TV show comes, it goes out into the world, and like that's kind of it. They will post the video, but I don't think those really have much of a life afterlife. Whereas a magazine article will get like surges of like, you know, someone will put it on Facebook and it'll go viral there, or it'll go on Apple News or something. And it's just, and it has links in it. I mean, I can't estimate how much it matters that just like, I mentioned the podcast, there was a link and you could click on the link and go to, in this case, the show page. And yeah, I mean, that just works really well. And I think we're still getting traffic off it. So
I would like to think the most effective piece was the one that we ran on Milwaukee.com, but that's just my internal bias.
Of course. I mean, it goes without saying.
But yeah, New York Magazine's a pretty good, I mean, that's okay also.
It went viral for them. My editor said that they had 350,000 hits or views.
Page views,
or something.
Yeah, that's not bad.
In like the first day and like 30 hours or something.
That's really good.
Yeah.
Okay. So last week's episode was the longest one we've ever done. It was very, very, there's a lot covered, right?
Yeah.
So I think this one, again, is going to be shorter. It's going to be a little less, maybe not even controversial, but you're not going to have to use your brain too much. But it's an important thing to talk about, right? Because we have some current questions to answer, because people on our YouTube page, on our Substack platform, I mean, we're interfacing with them and they're asking us questions.
Yeah. So the main point of this episode today, and I guess we've sort of swallowed the lead a little bit already, but this is about talk of Ocean Infinity and Malaysia restarting the seabed search in the Southern Indian Ocean,
right,
which they last did back in like 2018. So it's been a long bunch of years since anybody was looking for this plane, and there's talk about reviving it.
Yeah. There's often talk about reviving this, so we have to take that with a little bit of a
grain of salt. It has surfaced periodically.
So people asked you a couple of questions that I think are worthy of addressing, and then we'll get into the meat of the subject. So regarding this debris gap that we talked about in the last episode, which led us to the conclusion that this debris did not come from the South Indian Ocean.
So the debris gap is there's a year-long gap between the plane vanishing into the night and this material starting to grow sea life on it.
Right.
And since stuff, if stuff is in the water, it grows sea life right away. The implication is that it wasn't in the water for a year. So where was it for that year? And so people were like, wait a minute, there's got to be another easier explanation than just like somebody planting it.
Right. So one person asked you, or maybe several people asked you, if the debris could have sat on the bottom of the ocean floor for a year, then broke off and floated away.
So people have talked about like a ditching scenario where someone pulled a, you know, miracle on the Hudson, and they glided the plane and it stayed intact. And then, you know, whatever people did, then the whole plane sank as one whole piece and sank to the bottom for a year. And then the flap run broke off, floated to the surface, floated for 4 months to Reunion Island, gathering barnacles as it goes, and then it washes ashore.
Yeah, do you find that plausible?
That would explain the Lepus. But there's a big, big problem.
Okay.
One problem is, like, if you're on the bottom of the ocean, like, nothing happens. Like, I've been to, like, places in the Pacific where, like, World War II battles were fought. And, like, the things just sit there on the bottom, like, forever. Because nothing happens. What's going to break it off? A whale's going to bump into it? But a more pressing problem is that it takes a certain amount of time to drift all those thousands of miles. And they could barely figure out how it got there in 16 months, let alone 4 months. Like 4 months is not enough time to get there.
Okay.
So it's almost guaranteed that if the stuff did come from the impact site, the plane hit, broke into a million pieces, and then all those little pieces smashed, floated across like that.
Okay. I guess that makes sense. I mean, it's not like the Titanic gradually rose to the top of the ocean and people found
it. Didn't find pieces of the Titanic floating ashore like 5 years later.
The second question that people asked you was specifically about the flaperon breaking off from the rest of the wing while floating, and that somehow would have allowed the debris or the Lepus to grow in the right way. Am I phrasing that correctly?
Well, so this is even something that Jim Carlton brought up. He's like, maybe it was attached to something else, and that other thing was kind of like pushing it down.
Yeah.
And the problem is, this is a little bit less impossible, but the only thing that the flaperon can be attached to is the wing. That's what it's normally attached to. And it has like these two attachment points. And for that to happen, you have to imagine that like the plane hits the water, gets smashed into a million pieces, but these two pieces that are held together by like this armature don't come apart. And the armature is arranged in such a way that the wing, which itself is a pretty floatable thing, is holding it down. And, you know, this thing, just eyeballing it, it has like hundreds of pounds of flotation, right? I would think. And so to hold down that much force, it's very unstable. If you've ever like played around with like buoys or in the bathtub even. Oh, we got criticized for saying buoys. Someone's like, it's not pronounced buoy, it's pronounced boy. I'm like, actually, I looked it up because I had to look it up because I didn't know this.
I've never heard of
buoy. Boy is how you say it in the UK, in England.
Apologies.
Buoy, because we're Americans, that's how we say it. We're not being dumb, we're just being American, which is maybe the same thing.
Maybe the same thing.
Anyway, so you can't just like, it's really hard to hold something floatable down, you know?
Yeah.
It wants to come up. So anyway, so the idea is that it like hit the ocean, didn't come apart, floated all the way across the ocean, was held under in a way that isn't clear. Barnacles grew all over it. And then it came ashore and like broke just at that moment. And the flaperon stayed and the other piece floated away and
never to be found.
It. So it's like, it's not impossible to like, it requires a whole chain of like rather unlikely things.
Well, nonetheless, I'm glad that we're at least addressing these things.
mean, we did want to address it. They're not, they're really good questions, actually. I mean, I think that they are not viable as explanations, but I thought they were good questions, so I wanted to address them.
All right, keep them coming. All right, let's get into this thing. Okay. So after the authorities mathematically analyzed Inmarsat data to figure out where MH370 ran out of fuel in the southern Indian Ocean, the Australian government hired the Dutch Maritime Survey Company, Fugro, which you talked about.
Right, because they had defined... So wait, so just to like back up one step. What we're talking about is this... ultimately, what we're talking about is like, is there going to be another search and should there be another search? And if there is another search, will it be successful? So to lay the groundwork for that question, we're going to ask, well, why did they look in the Southern Ocean in the first place? And where did they look and how did they look? And that will help us understand whether they should look more.
And I think we've already kind of addressed some of this. This started in October 2014.
We definitely have.
In April 2015, they doubled the search size, asked Fugro to keep going.
I mean, I just want to, because I know that not everybody watches every episode. Right. So I just want to tell people about.
Jeff, do you think, because we talked about this before last week, like were we giving too much to people who had never seen this before? And we just kind of, like, we weren't sure, right? It's a lot to ask someone to watch 25 hours of a podcast and then see our bombshell. So
well, even if you haven't, it definitely was like a couple months ago, so it's worth a refresher.
Okay.
I'm sure people would appreciate the... Okay. Just a super bullet point, like...
Okay. So, well, actually, in the very first episode, our very debut episode, we talked to Peter Waring, who was one of the Australians who was conducting the search, about what it was like to work as part of that organization overseeing the search. And we have some more audio from that interview. So let's play some of that.
So the ATSB issued me this really fancy BlackBerry, but it was the first touchscreen BlackBerry. And I, you know, you're a naval officer, all of the work phones I'd had to that point were old Nokias that you could just... And then the ATSB were quite technologically savvy, IT-wise. And so I remember waking up vividly, and the first thing I would do is look at this fancy BlackBerry and see whether there's that email saying, we have a contact, we think it's an aircraft. And we were... I did this... kind of like a mock-up, right? So we have pictures of the debris field that they found for Air France 447, and I scaled it and put it across the data that we were producing and sent it to the ships to say, this is what it's going to look like. And we had a couple things that got close. There was one incident where we thought we may have found it. And it was funny because part of my job, and this was one of these, you know, there were all these little moments during this year where I thought, man... And I don't say this in the other podcast, but really I should, is that the ATSB were just the wrong organization to run a search, to run something of this magnitude. They'd never done anything like this before. And they really shouldn't have ever had any input to this whatsoever. When the French searched for Air France 447, they put an admiral in charge. And he developed his own team with various experts, but they had an operational guy in charge. They did not do that at the ATSB, and they really struggled for it. So there were a couple of Navy guys there, but we were... Yeah, I mean, I didn't come until the search area was drawn, and I could see things were going in the wrong direction and tried to do something about it. But this I think they would have recognized that the amount of information they had, the amount of evidence they had was minimal. And so drawing a search box whilst the analysis was still ongoing was probably politically necessary, but operationally it caused a lot of problems because it became very obvious at one point that we were looking in the wrong box. And what's interesting is after I left, the government said, we're going to finish 120,000 square kilometers and that's it. And so to try and get ahead of the game, the ATSB, and this was driven by Pete Foley, commissioned a new search strategy group to come up with a new search area based on all the evidence that they'd now uncovered. And a lot of that was to do with the drift modeling and also the work by Ian Holland, which is the rapid descent at the sixth arc. So using that data, they then drew this new box to the north of the box that we'd been looking in. It was 25,000 square kilometers, and they assigned a probability of around 90%. We are 90% sure that the aircraft is in that box.
So what Peter is saying is that they had done these calculations using the Inmarsat data, And the Inmarsat data, after some really fancy math, basically told them where the plane had gone. In a way, I want to like put a caveat on that immediately, because this data isn't like GPS data where it gives you latitude and longitude.
Yeah,
it basically tells you, if you give it a route, it will tell you whether that route matches it or not. So the way that you can figure out all the possibilities of where the plane might have gone is you create like a very huge, you sort of ran, it's called a Monte Carlo simulation.
You're right. I want to know what that means. That sounds like it makes me think of gambling, or it makes me think of James Bond or something.
It's like play like a thousand. If you can either calculate the probability of a certain hand of cards, or you can just play a million games of cards and see how many times it comes up. And so this is basically just doing that. It's randomly generate a lot of flight routes and then see which ones match the Inmarsat data. And you wind up getting a kind of a heat map.
Mm-hmm.
And they wound up sort of drawing a box on the southern seabed that encompassed like a 99% probability. And they were like, there's a 90%. That's pretty good. You know, if you told me there's a 99% chance you're going to give $1 million, I'll like definitely start thinking about it.
I would go to Monte Carlo and I would gamble.
If
there's a 99% chance of winning any game.
Yeah.
Even exactly. If it was in French, I would do it.
Même en français. So let's, so Peter is talking about, They had a 99% chance, and they send the boat out, and every day they're like, we're going to chip another piece out of this 99% probability, and one of them is going to be the payoff. Imagine, you know what it's like? Imagine if you had an advent calendar. My kids love advent calendars, right?
Okay.
And it's like, you know that in there, somewhere in there is there's a particularly good treat maybe. And like, you know that all you have to do is open 25, and one morning you're going to wake up and you're going to open it, and there's going to be the gold coin or whatever. And so that's what it was like for them. Every morning he would look at his phone or his BlackBerry, and it would be yes or no. And every morning he woke up thinking it's going to be yes. And it never was yes.
We talked about how people's spent so much time on this that their babies turned into toddlers, that they, what a crappy existence. I'm sure they were well compensated, but that must have been unbelievably deflating to think that you were going to find
the answer. I think it sounded like he kind of lost hope before some of his colleagues did. And they were just baffled.
Yeah.
And they were like, okay, wait, what did we get wrong? What did we miscalculate? And they were like, okay, wait, there's a certain assumption we assumed that the data was generated by this thing, but maybe it was generated by another thing. Maybe instead of going south at that point, it was actually not going south, but it was in a descent. And so that would explain why we didn't find it. So they made that assumption. It seemed kind of unlikely, but it was the last best hope. And they extended, they said, okay, listen, we didn't find it. We have run out of money. We have run out of time. We can't search it, but they issued a report saying like, this is, it has to be here. They were like, there's an 85% chance that it's in this last place that we didn't look.
A lot of this we covered in episode 11. We're talking right now about what the plane might have done as it was running out of fuel, where right. It could have been on the seventh arc, if it would have glided and then plunged headfirst into the ocean, if Zahari would have had a change of heart at the last minute, brought it back into a glide, then right. Plunged it into the ocean. So they considered all of these things as they kept expanding their search.
Yeah. Yeah. We might do an episode where we look we basically recreate that kind of final plunge. Maybe we'll do that pretty soon, actually. They were like, okay, this is where we left it before, which is that they were like, we didn't find it, but we know where it is. So long. See you later. And obviously a lot of the family members are not happy about that.
I would think not. And then Ocean Infinity gets involved.
Well, a year goes by. Everyone's like, oh, yeah. I guess that's a failure. But then this sort of white knight emerges.
Right. So I've got January 10th, 2016. Malaysia has contracted with Ocean Infinity. It's a U.S. company, and they say they're going to find it.
Right. So everyone was calling, oh, there's this U.S. company called Ocean Infinity, but it's like literally there's a name and like an address. That's it. We don't know anything about who these people are or where their money is coming from or what their motive is, but they just emerge out of nowhere and say, and they make this kind of unusual proposition, I would say, which is they say, okay, Malaysia, we know that you don't really want to spend any more money on this, but you don't have to spend any money on it unless we find it.
It's like a personal injury lawyer or something. You only pay if you win.
Contingency.
Yeah. Okay. Which, that's a lot of money to.
Well,
who are these guys?
I'm suspicious by nature. So I like my spider senses was tingling. I'm like, who is just running around with this money burning a hole in their pocket that they want to spend it on a search? I actually tried to reach out to the person that was listed like on this, you know, business registry. And mm-hmm. I'm like, you should talk to me before you go spend. I mean, it's always kind of killed me, Andy, that they were spending hundreds of millions of dollars. And meanwhile, I was like slowly going broke in this very difficult media environment. And I'd spent all this time and energy like, and I'd seen like I'd predicted that they wouldn't find it in the Southern Seabed. They didn't find it in the Southern Seabed. I felt like you should listen to me before you go running around. Like, why don't you spend some money figuring out what the heck's going on before you like run around the Southern Ocean for no good reason. Anyway,
I take it they didn't return your call.
You are 100% correct. They did not return my call.
Well,
in fact, before they sent off the ships, from some like Durban, South Africa, to go to the Southern Indian Ocean, they had a big party and they invited all the people, like the independent group people, all the people who were true, who like believed that it really is in the Southern Indian Ocean. They were flying people from like the United States to go like have a big party with them.
Did they invite you? I was not invited.
Aww. And I'm told, I think Peter Waring was at one of these parties. Maybe there was a different one that he was telling me, but he was telling me that they were kind of making fun of me. They were like drinking their drinks like in this
toast to that idiot Jeff Wise.
He's gonna be really sorry when he sees us finding the wreck at last. Anyway.
All right, well, I'm not there's no Scheidenfraude in this at least in my mind here, so I'm not happy that they still haven't found it, but I am
annoyed that they're spending all this money, right? They're spending all this money and they're so smug about it.
Yeah. Well, okay. So they said that they, instead of just using robot subs, they were going to use these AUVs, which sound like fancy drones.
AUVs is a fancy word for drones.
They're going to be more accurate. They're going to be faster. They did a bigger area in 1/9 the amount of time.
I mean, it's a testament to how incredibly fast technology is changing in this day and age.
Right.
That basically, you know, in the span of just a couple of years, because at the time that Fugro started the search back in 2014, what they were using was the state-of-the-art technology. And that had what Fugro did at the time was unprecedented. That had never been done that much, that deep, that quickly. So that was a huge like kind of landmark feat, but then it was obsolete within a couple of years that they had this new technology, which is instead of pulling something behind on a rope, basically, or a steel cable, really, they were letting them go free. Like a little flotilla of underwater, you know, robot babies
Robot babies. So smugness aside, do you think Ocean Infinity was a legit company that had the possibility of finding something had it been there?
I had no idea what it was. And of course, my imagination ran wild. But I didn't say anything because I didn't have any evidence one way or the other.
And you weren't invited to the party.
But I knew. Well, I later found out I wasn't invited to the party. Not that I would have gone anyway. but then Business Week, just a couple of months ago, we'll put a link in the show page. Just a couple of months ago, Business Week ran a really long article about the people behind Ocean Infinity. And it turned out they were basically like rich hedge fund people who had some money. They just had so much money that they were like, let's like take a high risk gamble. And they're basically treasure hunters. They're looking for like ships that sank during World War II full of gold and like Spanish galleons full of gold and stuff.
Have they found any?
I think they have. And one thing they did find was there was another great mystery where the Argentinians lost a submarine.
Yeah.
And it was like they had no idea where it was, and they went and they found it. So these guys are legit, actually.
Okay. Okay. Well, nonetheless, they didn't find anything. And
they searched an area. It took them like what it took Fugro like 2 years to do, they did in like 1/9 of the time. And they wind up searching actually a bigger area and probably more accurately too. So again, this is like technology kind of going by leaps and bounds.
So from time to time, Ocean Infinity expresses some interest in restarting the search, which is...
Oh, wait, can I tell you one more thing?
Oh, sure.
So apparently they found some shipwrecks, but they didn't tell the Malaysians anybody like what they were. Because this is their real business, is finding shipwrecks with maybe valuable support.
So wait a minute. So they were, you're telling me that they were on their mission for Malaysia, of which they would get paid if they found. And by the way, along the process, they found some shipwrecks that presumably had some value to them.
I mean, I would rather say they didn't have anything valuable on them, but they might have.
But had they, that would not have been Malaysia's bill
then
to
Malaysia
foot.
Would have no claim about it. No, not at all. They're like in international waters. I don't think anybody has a claim. I know nothing about it.
I don't specifically have a problem
it's
with
interesting,
that. It's notable. It's interesting.
Yeah, interesting. Remember, the Australians had said, like, there's this one area. It's like 25,000 square kilometers. It's got to be somewhere in there. And they said in their report, if it's not there, we are basically out of ideas. And so Ocean Infinity searched that 25,000 square kilometers and way beyond it, way, way, way beyond it, and didn't find it there either. So they're basically, remember I was starting to say before that, like, you the way you find where you should look is you do these Monte Carlo simulations. And every simulation results in every, like, you know, simulated flight path results in an end point where you run out of fuel and you crash into the ocean, right? And so, and for every end point, there's like basically a story. Like, I flew south at this speed. I took a turn at this point. If you want to look at any place beyond where you've already searched, pick a point and tell me what the story of that is. Because it's going to require changes of speed, changes of altitude, changes of fuel burn and so forth. And that gets you to that point. But what you wind up with is really kind of outlandish stories. Like the plane is taking just completely random turns, changing speed, flying at weird speeds for no reason. And so it gets very probabilistically unlikely.
Victor and the rest of the independent group suggested that Ocean Infinity's next search is farther away from the seventh arc, up to 45 nautical miles.
So when you're thinking about where to look, there's basically two questions that you can ask yourself, which is like, how far up and down the seventh arc should I look? And how far away from the seventh arc should I look? And basically, all of the people who assume that the Inmarsat data is real and valid and look at and have been looking at the debris drift modeling have all concluded that there's like actually a very, very narrow stretch of the seventh arc where this thing could have wound up when it sent that final ping. And so the only real viable choice now is to look further away. Well, there's two things, actually. You can look further away, or, and this is what Victor has spent a lot of time talking about, looking within the area that's already searched to see if there's like crevices or crannies or nooks or like the shadow of a cliff or something like that. He think it might, or maybe there was a bump that they like didn't look at closely enough and it was a piece. Maybe it couldn't be the whole plane because that would be too big, but maybe it's a piece of the plane and that's another clue. So basically they're looking at an area that has already been searched, but they want to look further away. So they've already looked up to, I think it's 25 nautical miles, and they want to extend that outwards a bunch of miles, maybe 43 or something. I'll have to check.
Hey, it's not my money. So if they want to do it.
Well, so the question is, okay, so as I said, like any place you're searching, you're basically positing a story.
Yeah.
And the story that they're positing is that the plane flew further than the authorities believed. Now, the entire initial search was based, remember, we spent a whole episode talking about how the plane was in a steep and accelerating dive and it was going almost straight down.
Yeah.
And then also because of the fact that the plane was found in these tiny pieces, even there were pieces of the cabin that were found, that meant that the whole thing must have been smashed to a million pieces.
Right.
So it was diving almost straight down and it was smashed into a million pieces. It seems like there's a very simple story to be told.
Yeah.
But how can you get further away from than 25 miles if you're like in a nosedive? And the answer is that he had a change of heart. He was halfway down this death slide and he's like, you know what? Actually, let me just glide as far as I can go. And I'm going to use the residual altitude that I still have to get me a little bit further. And then he's like, you know what? I've flown 43 miles and you know what? I had the right idea the first time. Let me put it back into a steep dive and I'm going to smash it into the ocean.
Again, I'm not a professional or amateur psychologist, but if you have the level of planning involved in your 6-hour suicide mission, you might think that someone would not have that change of heart at the very end for a few minutes.
So there's the issue of like the unlikelihood of the change of mind, but then there's also the unlikelihood of the timing, because all of these things have to happen within a like less than a minute window.
Right.
And he would have had to have a really sharp change of mind and then followed by another really sharp change of mind. So if you're going to say like, well, we think it could be further than 25, but probably not further than 43. It's like you're already, remember, they thought that they had searched like a 99% area, and then another whole bunch was searched, and you're left with the dregs after that. I mean, what you're left with is a place that at the beginning of the search you would have thought it was vanishingly unlikely. And so
I like that in our last episode, Ken said that you have to change when you, the priors, he called them. You have to be prepared to adjust your prior hypothesis based on what you find or what you don't find. But it seems to me like these guys are doubling down, tripling down, quadrupling down.
Their attitude is we are never going to reconsider the possibility that this data was tampered with.
Yeah.
Like we will go to the weirdest, you know, the weirdest, most unlikely, you know, we'd rather have it cartwheel end over end for 50 miles than to imagine that the data was tampered with.
Right.
Even though it seems increasingly uncontroversial that the data could be tampered with.
Yeah.
I think that the fact that they also don't want to revisit the weirdness of the biofouling on the debris.
They want to revisit anything.
They don't want to revisit anything.
Again, it's not our money. Go for it. But we've already put it out there. We're saying the plane did not go south into the southern Indian Ocean. They're looking in the wrong place.
Well, we're not saying it. We're not exactly saying it didn't. What we're saying is that the Bayesian priors, if you reassess your Bayesian priors, you're going to get a different probability distribution of what's possible. And the idea that these, you know, multiple unlikelihoods, you know, chained one after the other that are necessary in order to get an endpoint in the Southern Indian Ocean at this point is relatively small in relation to a spoof hypothesis. And I guess I'm not, and again, it's, I think this is what we started this entire series, like saying, like, we're not trying to tell you like this is definitely what happened, but we're trying to get you to shift your assessment of what are the options you should be looking at.
Okay, so can I say that we probably don't think that the plane is in the Southern Indian Ocean? Okay. Are you okay with that?
I mean that's like,
I feel kind of dumb after saying all those things.
I'm like the lawyer. I'm like lawyering it.
Okay.
It's true. I mean, you could, the upshot is that like, we think it's more likely that the plane was, the data was spoofed than that the data was not spoofed.
Fine. I'll go with that.
But so if the question is, should we get excited for an Ocean Infinity search? Because a lot of family members have been pushing for exactly this. Continue the search. You promised you'd search until they found it. You haven't found it, so keep searching. And what I'm saying personally is I wish you wouldn't, actually, because I think it's time to accept defeat. I think it's time to say we have enough basis to revisit our priors. If this thing is possible, then we need to explore it. And I think, and so I basically, it's like giving another delay for a trial that has already been solved. You know what I mean? I don't think this trial needs another appeal.
I mean, I suppose on the upside, if they look for it and spend a bunch of time, money, and new technology, and they continue to not find it, it will be increasingly harder for them to say, we must have just missed it. Maybe.
I mean, that's an interesting idea. I mean, I felt back in 2015 when I, you know, first went public with this spoof idea that like if they search where they say they've assured the public it was going to be in the first search area.
Yeah.
And they didn't find it. I thought then people would be like, oh, OK, well, we need to revisit this idea. It didn't happen. Didn't happen after the first Ocean Infinity search. I wonder, like, is there ever enough negative information that you will start to say, wait, maybe our premise is faulty?
I guess we'll find out. That's why I wanted to preview what's coming up in this podcast.
Okay. Okay.
Because to me, Jeff, I've talked to many, many people about this, and they always ask me two questions. Like, They say, like, if you, okay, let's take your theory and go with it. What happened so what happened to the plane?
Right. And why?
And why?
Yeah.
And to date, we have kind of led up to that process of answering that question. We haven't done a ton of speculation as to what happened to the plane, if it made it to or near Kazakhstan, and more importantly, why. And we have stuff
to say about
that.
It's because I have PTSD. I've been talking about this for a long time, and it's like the minute I get to saying that Russia took it, people historically have been like, okay, I'll see you later. Because people, because it sounds crazy to people. And so what I've tried to, so I've sort of learned to, like, my urge has become to want to, like, just stitch up everything super, super tight. And so when we start talking about, okay, where does that mean the plane went? And I start talking about Putin, people aren't just like, oh, you're one of those. You know what I mean?
I do know what you mean, because the first conversation I had with you on the phone after I met you via Twitter, after watching the Netflix documentary, me being me, I wanted to cut to the chase. I'm like, all right, so where's the plane? Why? Mm-hmm. And like, maybe it was because you didn't know me very well or at all.
Yeah.
You like just wouldn't answer that question. I was like,
I said, well, before I answer that question, let me tell you why they think it went south. Right.
Yeah. 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 I was like, okay, I got it. So, but anyway, I mean, come on, we're in this thing. We're on episode 26. Sooner or later, we're going to have to talk about,
I guess, we're on our, guide you 26th through your date. So it's like, time
I will
to
guide
up,
you
right?
through, I'll guide you through your PTSD, Jeff. And we will start getting into that stuff. So I just want the readers and the listeners and the viewers to know that it's coming. And despite the fact that you don't want to do it, it's something that actually,
it's not that I don't want to do it. I just want to make sure that we have carefully laid the groundwork for it.
I think
it's like we're building a skyscraper and it needs to have a firm foundation.
Yeah. Well, it's getting pretty tall. And the other thing, and I'm not going to reveal this, is you do have some information that nobody else has on those two questions.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
No, true. You do. You do.
Oh, because I told you and I haven't told anybody else.
Yeah, but you told me. Thank you.
Okay.
Because you kind of have to.
There's a lot of things that I know that I haven't told. Some of them are like pretty actionable.
Right.
But
that's responsible journalism, right? You don't just throw stuff out there without making sure that you've dotted your I's, crossed your T's and stuff. But people should know that from here on out, it's not just imagination, science fiction, alt history. Like there's
yeah,
more
it's
to
never
tell.
Been science fiction. And like along these lines, I would say that you and I, you know, spent a lot of time dotting our I's and crossing our T's in preparation for last week's episode, because we felt like we were making some pretty big claims and we wanted to make sure that it would hold up. And we haven't really gotten any pushback. I mean, maybe people just haven't had time to kind of really do that, but I feel like I'm glad that we really took our time, because I think it is really solid.
Me too. I was really pleased with that one. So this is the part where now this is no longer just lip service, that like and subscribe stuff, because the algorithm is really playing in our favor. And unfortunately, that's the way the world works. And this is a cumulative sort of thing. It's not just like with each like and subscribe things change, but we're entering into that echelon of publishing where people are finding us.
Right.
And a lot of that's the earned media that we've been doing. It's a lot of the offline stuff we've been doing. Some of it has been taking the revenue from our advertising and putting it right back in.
Yeah.
But people who like this should be telling their friends. They should, if you're watching it for the first time, that like and subscribe thing and joining as a member, actually makes a difference.
If you're listening to this and you could just like click like, that simple act would actually help us a lot. And of course, if you want to go even further, and really kind of propel this thing out into the world even more, if there is a bat, you can buy badges on the YouTube page. If you go to the Substack, which is deepdivemh370.com, you can buy a subscription, which a whole bunch of people did in the last week, actually, which was amazing and awesome. And Andy and I are both really very grateful.
Really, yeah.
To those people, so we really appreciate it.
Yeah, and the people who have in businesses who have been sponsors are seeing some amazing returns. I can't wait to have that postmortem with Ditch GPS.
Oh, so yeah, that was fun.
Episode 25 sponsor was a really cool one. Yeah. So again, if that sounds like something that you might be interested in, visit our show page at deepdivemh370.com. Email me at andy@onmilwaukee.com. We'll talk about it. Let's wrap this one up before it gets super duper long, because there's a lot of work ahead of us, and wow, we did a lot of work in the last week.
Yeah.
You, maybe you more than me, but
We both worked really hard. It was a lot. It was a lot.
See you next week, Jeff.
All right. Thanks, Andy. Thanks, all our viewers and listeners. Thanks for supporting us, and we'll see you next week.
Bye-bye.